next case is SureFit Home Products et al. Versus Matex Mills, 2021-2048. Mr. Cohen, please proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Morris Cohen, and I represent plaintiffs SureFit and their affiliates. Your honors, the lower court here ruled that the accused product is not within the scope of the claim. 4 months before it actually determined the scope of the claim. In denying the preliminary injunction, it conducted its infringement analysis in May, but it did not conduct claim construction until the following October. That went against basic patent principles. As is well known, a court must always construe the claim first when determining whether there is infringement. Even for that reason alone, the PI decision should be reversed.
Is that true in the design patent infringement context? I thought this court has said in a handful of different opinions that claim construction isn't necessary in a design patent infringement context. And in fact, sometimes it's quite a dangerous thing to do because it can tend to mislead when converting an illustration into written form.
I'm going with a pause always so there's no overlap, excuse me. So we submit that, for example, in this case, when the plaintiff has an allegation by the defendant that there's functional features, claim construction must proceed. The court must determine whether or not certain features are functional under, for example, Lennard, this court's decision in Lennard, which says that when you have potentially functional elements, you must construe whether or not they're functional to determine whether they're part of the claim. And in addition, in this court's earlier decision before Lennard, of course, in Egyptian Goddess, this en banc court held that these courts have a duty to conduct claim construction design cases, particularly since there can be issues of functionality, the importance of dotted lines, which are not part of the claim, solid lines, which are part of the claim. We submit the claim construction is necessary. Of course, if this were a case where all the lines were dotted and there were no allegations of functionality and so forth, then claim construction would be potentially superfluous because it would serve no purpose. But in a case such as this one, where we have functional allegations that the court, of course, rejected later on, and when we have issues of dotted lines and so forth, we believe that claim construction was mandatory. Otherwise, there's no way to determine whether the accused product does or does not fall within the scope of the claim unless the court first determines what the scope of the claim is.
Mr. Cohen, your problem is that this is on a preliminary injunction. Steep standard of review.
Yes, Your Honor. However, even on a preliminary injunction, the court must follow the law of this court. And in conjunction with its decisions, it repeatedly did not give weight to features and to allegations and to factors that this court said are important. For example, on the claim construction side, the court was faced with both parties both agreeing on what the departure was from the prior art. The vertical slit was agreed by both parties to be a departure from the prior art. And the court ruled that it's non-functional in its later decision. And yet the vertical slit was given absolutely no weight in the infringement decision or non-infringement decision. The court had to give weight to that considering that it's non-functional. And it had to give extra weight to that considering the fact that everyone agreed it's the departure from the prior art. Under Egyptian Goddess and its progeny, the departure from the prior art, of course, gets extra weight. Considering the fact that the court gave no weight to it, it's not, in our opinion, it's not a sustainable opinion. That opinion cannot be reconciled with the opinions and the decisions of this court guiding the district court. The district court has discretion, but a failure to follow the law of this court is always an abuse of discretion. Likewise, there are other factors that this court has said must be considered, which the district court did not. For example, this court has always said that all of the views of a design patent must be considered in construing whether there is or is not infringement. But the district court did not consider all of the views. For example, it did not consider the top or bottom views at all, even though the top and bottom views of the design patent are identical to the top and bottom views of the accused design. Likewise, The district court gave no weight to the side views, even though the left and right sides of the accused design are very close to the design patent. So whereas the district court has some discretion, it does not have the discretion to disregard the established case law of this court that must consider the overall similarities, not just focus on differences, and it must consider all views. With respect to overall similarities, I note that, for example, in Crocs, this court has cautioned district courts against focusing on individual small differences instead of looking at the overall design. We respectfully submit that the district court focus on individual small differences instead of considering the overall design. In fact, in its short reference to the overall design, it said that they're very similar, and then it went on and said, but there are these small differences.
Mr. Cohen, on irreparable harm, when someone has a product that constitutes the major source of revenue for the company, and it loses that through competition, that can be irreparable harm. But the court's opinion sounds like there was an inadequate foundation made for that argument. Plaintiffs identify no reason why damages would be insufficient. And I think said that they're speculative. Would you address that, please?
Yes, Your Honor, of course. We submit, as Your Honor indicated, that irreparable harm, well, to go back to the factors on irreparable harm, this court has likewise set forth factors which indicate whether there is or is not irreparable harm. And a factor that's important and that's frequently weighed is whether there's going to be a loss of market share. A loss of market share is direct evidence of irreparable harm. And here there is a loss of market share. The plaintiffs have lost market share and they continue to lose market share. Likewise, another factor, and the court did not give any weight to that below. Likewise, another factor which is important is whether or not the parties are direct competitors. Here the parties are direct competitors. That's supposed to be a factor weighing towards irreparable harm. But again, the district court gave it no weight.
What was the evidence of loss of market share?
Yes, Your Honor. So examples of loss of market share are, for one, our client has lost shelf space in Home Depot to the defendant. In addition, our client used to sell to a large seller for the military called the Army Air Force Exchange. They no longer sell the product. Our product has been discontinued. Army Air Force Exchange is selling defendant's product.
Well, that piece of evidence didn't materialize until after the court made its decision. Is that right?
That is correct.
You weren't able to present that to the district court. I don't know if we can rely on that to say that the district court somehow abused its discretion on irreparable harm.
That is correct. That
is there any evidence in the record that says we had 20% of the national shower curtain market, and now because we have to compete with this accused infringer, we're now down to, 10% of market share. And even if we prevail in this lawsuit, we're just not going to be able to climb back to 20% due to some structural obstacles that are going to make it hard for us to recoup the previously lost market share. Is there something like that in the record?
Your Honor, there's no percentages at the early stage, but there is structural evidence of that sort. For example, it was put into the record that the customers for these types of products are quote-unquote sticky customers. They're customers who are loyal to the brand of first purchase. This is particularly important because they come back to buy the shower curtain liners, which have to be replaced every 6 months or so. The evidence in the record, which was not rebutted and which was not even addressed by the district court.
How can you show the loss or gain of market share without discussing percentages?
Well, the
word share presumes, by definition, a percentage.
Yes, Your Honor. Whereas we don't have the overall market share of all retailers, we do have certain information. We have, for example, our market share in hospitality, which the plaintiff is the number one seller in hospitality. We also have the fact that in Home Depot and other customers, instead of being the only seller where we would have 100% of the market share in Home Depot, we're now sharing market space.
That's not, that's, having shelf space in Home Depot is not market share. You have to define the market. You have to establish the shares of the market that belong to the competitors. Then you have to show a loss of market share due to the design issue that we have here.
Yes, Your Honor. However, our problem is that if the plaintiff is selling a product and then the defendant is selling a directly competing product as direct customer competitors, that's evidence under this court's case law that it is irreparable harm. And in addition, it has to be a loss of market share if we're not the exclusive anymore, even though we have a patent, and if the defendant is taking away from sales that we otherwise can make. In addition, there are issues such as loss of brand recognition, goodwill, the fact they infringe the entire product. All of these are factors that this court has taken into effect and weighed in terms of determining irreparable harm, sticky customers. The lower court did not consider any of those factors. They didn't give it any weight. Market share is one issue. Direct competitors is another. She didn't give away.
Before we hear from the other side, could I just hear from you the nature of this design patent on shower curtain rings? What do you think is the inventor's contribution to the ornamental arts? And assume for the moment that I don't really see anything particularly decorative or ornamental about the patented design. It just looks like rings with a very functional slit in the ring in order to attach and detach the shower curtain from the shower rod.
May I proceed now because I'm in my rebuttal time, or should I stop with what's preferable?
No, please proceed.
Okay, thank you. So in terms of the ornamentality, the Patent Office considered that and ruled that it was ornamental. And, of course, this court has looked at features.
I know, but I'm telling you right now, I assume for the moment, I don't see anything that looks ornamental to me. So could you please describe what is decorative and ornamental about what otherwise to me just looks like a plain, straightforward, functional design?
I would be happy to. There are various features. First of all is the fact that there are many alternative ways to make shower curtains, as shown by all the different products on the market. Hooks, for example. This is a much neater look than a hook that sticks above the top of an edge and dangles and is not neat looking. If you look at the rings in the design patent, all of the rings are below the upper edge of the curtain. Not a single ring goes above it, as opposed to hooks that go above it, and as opposed to other products like the defendant's own product, which has the rings extending above the top of the edge, the Zenith product, for example.
Is the validity of this patented issue here?
Not at this stage, no, Your Honor. At the preliminary injunction stage, I don't believe that there's not an issue, Your Honor.
So we don't get into ornamentality here.
Okay. I would like to, with the court's permission, reserve our remaining time for rebuttal.
We will do that. Mr. Morseberg.
May it please the court. I'm Doug Morseberg. I represent Matex Mills, Inc., the appellee. Your Honor, the trial court's decision was correct, and it was correct for a lot of reasons. There are many hurdles that the SureFit parties need to get over to have this decision either vacated or reversed.
Counsel, the accused product sure looked like what's in the design patent. They're awfully close.
Well, and that, of course, is the primary issue. I think initial impressions go a long way. And I think some people can look at and the trial court looked at these photographs of the accused product and the drawings of the patented product, the claim, and said, you know what, these things are substantially different. So when counsel says that the trial court made a determination that this product was not within the scope of the patent, that's not what she did. What she did is she looked at these designs, the accused design and the claimed design, and she said, flat off, right off the bat, these things are not similar. They're not similar enough. They're plainly dissimilar. Now, counsel says that it's a requirement for the court to construe the design patent in every case prior to making any kind of a ruling. That's simply not true. The court in Egyptian Goddess said, and I'll quote it, I quoted it in my paper, and this is at the, it's the, Egyptian Goddess 543 F3rd 665 678. And the court said, in some instances, the claimed design and the accused design will be sufficiently distinct that it will be clear without more that the patentee has not met its burden of proving the two designs would appear, open quote, substantially the same, close quote, to the ordinary observer as required by Gorham. In other instances, when the claimed and accused designs are not plainly dissimilar, resolution of the question of whether the ordinary observer would consider the two designs to be substantially the same will benefit from a comparison of the claimed and accused designs with the prior art. So what the court's saying is, and I'll just give you an example. Let's just say for the sake of argument, the patentee has a design patent on a slipper, and it accuses a bootmaker of infringing the patent on the slipper. Well, the court can simply look at the two, the claim design and the accused design, and say, you know what? This boot doesn't look anything like the slipper.
That's quite different.
Can say, well, Your Honor, they both have soles. They both have laces. They both have welts. And the court could say, you know what? It's just not close enough. They're not similar enough. They are plainly dissimilar.
Counsel,
that's what the court did in this situation.
Counsel, would
it
you? What,
two
counsel,
and
would
it
you?
Said,
counsel,
these
can you not hear us?
Dissimilar.
Can you not hear us?
Yes.
Then would you try to be sensitive to the judges trying to ask a question, which is the main point of the hearing?
I've lost audio.
That's the problem then. All right, so wait a minute.
Oh, yeah, his microphone is not working.
Oh,
it's on this side.
Now, well, the audio cut out. I saw one of Your Honors wave to me. My audio was going in and out. I can't tell whether you
can you hear us? Can you hear us now?
I can hear you now.
Okay.
All right. Well, our case is not like the slipper and the boot case. We're looking at these circular openings, and the shower rail goes right through them in the same way. The only differences seem to be these slits, which are rather minor, and the beveling, which is fairly minor. So this is quite different from the boot versus the slipper case.
Well, the claimed design has flat rings, pancake flat rings. The accused design on the front side has what looks like a crater, actually. It's a three-dimensional ring. And on the backside, it has a hook, and it has post holes, I think 8 post holes. And those are distinct differences from the claimed design. Now, the court said, these things bear a high level resemblance, you know, at a high level. They both have rings, and they both have slits. But other than that, that's where the similarity ends. And then the court went on to say, these differences are plain on their face. They are plainly apparent, significant, and obvious in plain view. Anyway, and so the court wasn't buying the similarity, and the court just simply made a determination that we're not going to issue an injunction in this case because the two designs are not similar enough. Now, the court subsequently entered a claim construction order, but that didn't affect the ruling on the motion for preliminary injunction. The claim construction order simply says, this is what the patent, this is what the scope of the patent is. It has two rings, it has, it extends downward to the bottom and it extends out to the right, and it has a slit, which is, and the court said, slit's part of the design, and I believe the court said it's not functional. But that's got nothing to do with whether these designs are plainly dissimilar or not. I want to address the irreparable harm issue, which Your Honor's asked about. And what the court said basically is, you have a bunch of supposition, you have a bunch of assumptions, and you're not supporting anything with hard facts. And so what we have in the declarations that support the
Counselor, am I correct that the court made its irreparable harm analysis based on infringement as opposed to validity analysis?
It's irreparable harm?
Yes.
Determination? No, it made its irreparable harm determination based on the fact that the SureFit parties didn't support their claim with facts, supportable facts. They had a bunch of supposition, and I'll just briefly, the declaration of Roberts, this is a declaration of Erickson, for example. He said, well, you know, SureFit sales to Home Depot were about $500,000 less than expected, and replenishment orders are lagging, which, in SureFit's opinion, is the result of the accused product.
Okay, let me redirect you. Let's go to the likelihood of success. Was that consideration based on an infringement analysis or a validity analysis?
An infringement analysis, Your Honor.
Is that error?
I beg your pardon?
Is that an error? Should it have been based on validity?
No, it can be based on either. The court, the Egyptian Goddess Court says that the trial court can make a determination that these designs, the accused design and the claimed design, are plainly dissimilar. Such that, and by the way, such that the plaintiff doesn't even make out a claim. Now, the court said there is a substantial issue here, and that's why she denied the injunction, because there was a substantial issue as to the likelihood that the plaintiffs were going to prevail on their infringement claim. That was the basis for the denial of the injunction on that likelihood of success ground.
Anything further?
Yes. One of the basic tenets of appellate practice is that you only decide cases based on what was in front of the trial court. And it's also a basic tenet of appellate practice that you only bring before the appellate court stuff that was before the trial court. And in the gray brief, the appellant's gray brief, there are at least three things which they talk about which are not before the trial court and have no basis, they have no place in the brief themselves. And I think it's completely improper for counsel to have included those. And
What are those three things?
At page 43, page 17, and the page 17 is the page at the top of the brief. They refer to events that have transpired in the trial court but are not in the record before the court. And it's something about motion practice, motion under 12C, 12C, that the court said, well, you can bring that later on. It has no basis. It's not even relevant to anything. They've quoted some deposition testimony allegedly given by a former Matex employee who was fired from the company. That's in the gray brief, docket 43, page 23. And they've attempted to bolster their argument that the trial court's finding on the irreparable harm issue was error by averring that they've recently lost a particular customer, and that's AFES, A-A-F-E-S. You talked about that one just briefly. That's at docket 43, page 28. There are some other things, but these are the main ones that jumped out at me as I was going through their brief. So, Your Honor, I just want to say this is a strict standard of review here. The trial court gets a lot of deference, and if this court is convinced that a significant and a definite, if this court has a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been committed, then you know what? It can disregard the court's findings, the trial court's findings. But if it's on the fence at all, if it says, well, I'm not really sure I would have decided it that way, well, I don't really know, maybe I would have decided it differently, that's not a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made. And if that's what the court's feeling is, it has to. It has to affirm the court's findings on the likelihood of success issue. And even if the court decides against, decides that there was a mistake made there, then it still has two other hurdles that it has to get over. And one of the hurdles is, in connection with the irreparable harm issue, the SureFit parties were required to establish a connection between their alleged irreparable harm and the alleged infringement. And there's nothing in the record below that relates to this. Their sole reasoning about why there's harm is that Matex's product is sold for a lower price. So there's nothing to say that the patented article, the accused article, there's a demand for it because of the patented feature. This doesn't exist. And they cannot, without that, they can't prevail on their irreparable harm issue. Now, in their gray brief, counsel said, well, what else could it be? Well, that's not evidence. That's just argument. And so my time is up. I would respectfully request that the court affirm the trial court's opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Cohen has a little rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the injunctive relief factors, I would like to point to Matex's own testimony. Matex testified that it's likely to take over this market. It indicated, and reciting Appendix 354 to 355, it said that, quote, based upon my 36 years as a senior executive in this industry, I know that big box retailers would rather deal with one reliable supplier such as Matex than multiple single product suppliers, end quote. Matex indicates that us being a smaller single product supplier, we're at a disadvantage, and the big box retailers and members of the market would rather purchase their products from Matex. That itself is important evidence that there's likelihood of irreparable harm that the court below did not consider at all. If the customers are more interested in buying their products from Matex, according to Matex's own testimony, because they offer a plurality of products, and not interested in purchasing products from a smaller company like ours based upon his experience in the industry. And we agree with that, that there's a likelihood that they're going to take over the market. Both parties agree on specific facts that indicate market problems for the plaintiff, which the district court did not even consider in her decision, requiring either reversal or remand. Whereas the district court does have discretion, there's no discretion to eliminate or to ignore evidence in the record, particularly evidence from the defendant itself that contradicts the defendant's position and that corroborates what the plaintiff has been saying. This is particularly important here when you have a balance of hardships in which the plaintiff's core of their entire business is this product. And this is just a minor product of defendants, some peripheral issue. And the defendants are taking sales in a market the plaintiff created. The defendants are taking over, and they indicate they're likely to take over, the very market the plaintiff created, using a product that's very similar and that is basically designed to look like our product, considering that the defendants knew about our IP when they went out with and came out with our product, and even met with the inventor, who notified them that this IP was under exclusive license. So these are facts, this evidence the district court was obligated to consider, facts about Matex's likelihood of taking over, which we respectfully submit require either reversal or at least remand, so the district court should consider the evidence of the record, because it would be an abuse of discretion not to consider evidence, including admissions by Matex's own counsel. I see my over my time, so unless the court has further questions, I'm available to answer those questions, but otherwise I recognize that the time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Appreciate the arguments, and the case is submitted.